time now for the Conservative Watchdog Weekly News Review with Dr. Lou Campomanosi, president of the Common Sense Campaign and adjunct professor of political science at Spring Hill College, paid for by Kevin Spriggs Enterprises. Well, good morning, Dr. Lou.
Well, hello, Mark. Good to see you. Hope you had a good Thanksgiving, and I hope that everyone out there listening also had a good one. So here we are, back to the grindstone, but it's a welcoming grindstone, I have to say. I mean, this whole question about what's going on in our state and our nation, those are important, you know, topics for us to cover. So this morning, I want to switch away from, you know, the foreign policy issues that we talked about last week with Dee Cox and talk about, you know, what's going on in Alabama. And I've invited our current state auditor, Jim Agitator Ziegler, to speak with us, and Stephanie Dernan, who is the co-director of one of the most important of our groups that fights for health freedom, and she is the co-director of Health Freedom Alabama. So I do want to get into that in just a minute, but I'm running a little bit late here right now, so I see that Jim Ziegler's calling in, so let's go ahead and take his call, and we'll kick it off.
Or perhaps not.
Well, okay, now that I have a few minutes and that phone was not Jim Ziegler, let me just talk quickly about an editorial in the New York Slimes, formerly the New York Times. Okay, Mark Levin is absolutely right to call in the Slimes, okay? The title of this is How a GOP Faction Enables Political Violence. They're talking about the Proud Boys. Now, the Proud Boys are a bunch of idiots, okay? There's no question about that. But the way the Times frames this, it's all about them being the most, you know, the biggest danger in terms of political terrorism. Now, let me just ask you this. The last time that you saw a Planned Parenthood place attacked was when? Haven't seen one in a long, long time, okay? When's the last time you saw something that was a place for pro-life people to bring to bring anti-abortion, you know, messages out? How many times did you see that get attacked during the past year? A whole lot, okay? So I don't want to hear about domestic terrorism being the central issue that all of our so-called agencies talk about when all of those kinds of political violent things were done against the pro-life, you know, folks in this country, number one. Number two, I don't want to hear about political violence only from the Proud Boys when in 2020 political violence was allowed in Portland and in Minneapolis and other cities like that controlled by the Democrats, okay? That's who controls them, okay? And today you still have political violence, except it's called crime. There's no difference between what goes on in Chicago and Baltimore every weekend where four or five people are killed, you know, 30 and 40 shot. And guess what that is? That is a form of terrorism, okay? And it's allowed to go on. So I don't want to hear from the New York Slimes about how the GOP has been taken over by a faction of idiots. That's not the case, okay? Now, here is another phone call coming in, and I bet this is going to be Jim Ziegler. Jim, I really appreciate your coming on. It's been a while, and of course, it's just been a crazy season with all the elections and all like that. But I did want to, you know, have you come on and give us your take on some of the major issues facing the electorate today. Now that the elections are over, what are some of the issues that you're concerned with for our state as we go forward?
Well, on the good news side, the Republicans have taken over the U.S. House of Representatives, and we're going to be electing a new speaker to take the place of Nancy Pelosi.
Yes.
And so that's good. So it's going to be so important now that the House, the U.S. House leadership, put together a people's program, a conservative program to move forward and also to play defense and block any further of the Biden or Democrat program. So that's good. Now, on the national scene, not taking back the U.S. Senate was a real disappointment.
Right.
I'm particularly concerned about Biden's appointments to the federal judiciary. He will have a much easier time getting those confirmed by the Senate than he would have if we had won two more U.S. Senate races. I just don't understand some of these states. It looked like an unelectable Democratic candidate got elected, such as Pennsylvania.
Well, I mean, you know, Jim, just let me just ask you this, though. I mean, the way Mitch McConnell, you know, misused his funds, it seems to me he picked and chose winners. And we've lost, you know, Blake Masters in Arizona. He supported Murkowski up in Alaska, and she's back. And then, you know, Bukele in New Hampshire. I mean, there were wins there. And of course, you know, with Walker still going to be the balancing act here, which will be helpful if he wins, and supposedly Kemp is helping him, then maybe, you know, the status quo remains as it is, and that puts the Democrats sort of at a disadvantage because, you know, they have a couple of people who have, you know, wandered off the reservation, like Manchin and Sinema. So I guess what I'm saying here is I'm hoping that Walker will win and at least keep the status quo in the Senate.
It will help greatly to avoid the Democrats having a working majority. They'll have an on-paper majority to organize the Senate.
Right.
They know that already. They'll organize the Senate committees and the chairmanships, and that's such a disappointment. But we can pick up one or two or three Democratic votes on particular issues. So I have friends over in Georgia campaigning for Herschel Walker, and that's become a national runoff in the state of Georgia.
Yeah, exactly.
Herschel to win over there. But by and large, we've got two more years of playing defense in Congress
right.
against the Biden White House. And then hopefully we can get back.
Let's hope so. So as far as the national scene goes, I think you've put your finger on it. What about in Alabama? What is your sense of what's happening here and the issues that we've been particularly concerned about?
The legislative session starts the 1st of March coming up in 23. And I would say, number one, will there be any tax cuts? Right now, both the education fund and the general fund have more money than they've ever had before. They have an abundance of money to fund the existing programs. If there's ever going to be a cut in Alabama's high sales tax, this
right.
is the time to do it. If there's ever going to be an opportunity to remove the tax on groceries and prescriptions, this is the time to do it. But at this moment, I don't see much movement in that direction. So somebody, some citizen, some group is going to have to take a leadership role and get legislators, what's called carry those bills, get a sponsor, bills written, get them put into the hopper, get a number, and start a campaign just to hope that the tax cuts happen. Tax cuts don't happen in Montgomery. They
right.
fought for and won. And right now, I don't see much activity trying to lead the fight to get some of this money back. We're awash in money in Montgomery between the budgets and the federal monies that have been coming in.
Well, let me ask you this, since this question about the money is there. As related to one of the big concerns we have is for the I-10 bridge. So the question that I think is there is there's supposed to be $2.5 billion in infrastructure money. There's also something that's been hanging out there that they keep talking about, which is a $500 million grant from the Transportation Department under Buttigieg, okay, which I've classified that as nothing more than a house of cards financing scheme. But nevertheless, with all this money that you're talking about here, what is your sense that, that the I-10 bridge funding may actually come to pass?
I understand that some calls have been put in to the Senate finance chair, Senator Greg Allbritton, who also has the northern part of Paul County in his district.
Right.
And I think there needs to be an immediate discussion. Should some of that $3 billion be sought for an I-10 bridge fix, and some of the transportation secretary's $500 million, and of course there's some other grants that have already been secured of much smaller numbers for the I-10 bridge, but the money is there to do the I-10 bridge project without a toll.
Right.
The problem is nobody in the Ivy administration or in Washington is taking the lead trying to put together the money to fix I-10 without a toll. It's everybody's sitting around just assuming that the toll is a done deal. And maybe Greg Allbritton could be the one that could step forward. He's certainly in a position to do that, and I hope I'll hear a report from those conversations.
Well, I have a call in to Senator Allbritton, and I'm supposed to talk to him later on after we're finished with the show. And that has been a question that I've asked him repeatedly, and you know, he basically I think is supportive of our position on this, but his hands have been tied in terms of not really knowing where this money that they keep talking about is coming from. Well, maybe now we'll have a better picture to look at, okay? So, but I appreciate your take on that, and I think that it is important that we have an understanding of how this money, if this money is available, then how it's going to be distributed. And of course, isn't that the central question? I mean, you know, our needs down here are not necessarily the needs of North Alabama, and they do have, you know, the final say in how money gets distributed, as we saw with the oil money that went up to North Alabama when the people down here are the ones who suffered from the oil spill.
And I hope that they can get it through their heads that Interstate 10 is not a local road. It is not a Baldwin County project. It's not a Mobile County project. This is an interstate highway, a federal highway that goes from Jacksonville, Florida to Santa Monica, California. And a tremendous amount of the tourism and commerce shipping for the Alabama industries comes off of Interstate 10.
Yeah.
So it should be paid for by federal dollars.
It should be. Well, we'll see what happens. So, Jim, what are some other issues that you're looking at that we need to address to folks to have an understanding of what's going on out there?
Okay. First thing, I've got some good news. I hear people keep talking about we need to ban critical race theory in the schools, and I'm glad to bring good news. That has been done. The State Board of Education, which controls policy matters of that nature, has passed a resolution banning critical race theory and anything else by whatever other name is put to it that has the same ingredients. And they passed the resolution, and not surprisingly, all the Republican members of the State Board of Education voted to ban critical race theory, and all the Democrat members voted against it. Not to stop there, they figured that a resolution by that board is not the strongest medicine available, so they came back the next month, and they passed the resolution amending the state administrative code, which is the strongest action that the State Board of Education can legally take, and they ban critical race theory and anything by whatever name that does the same kinds of things in the state administrative code. So we're in good shape on that. Now, there needs to be follow-up. You know, everybody says the devil is in the details.
Yeah.
I say the devil is in the follow-up. What kind of follow-up? How are you going to be sure that some teacher or some school principal is not indoctrinating with critical race theory anyway, despite the ban? So we've got to organize something for parents to be on the lookout and some methodology for them to report it if they detect a violation of the ban on critical race theory. So this is a major step in the right direction, and that's good.
Well, I agree with you there, and I know that your wife, Jackie, who is on the State Board of Education, we met with Dr. Renee Carter, who is the academic director for Baldwin County, and we're moving in that direction, and that issue was brought up, and we're also working with her to look at this whole question of one of the sources that they use for their elementary school history. It's called the States Weekly. I think that's the name of it. And what our team has discovered is that this is just a left-wing rag. They've made some changes, but the reality is that this document should not be being used. And so I think our proposal is going to be, let's pull that out of Baldwin County schools and let's substitute it with something from Hillsdale College that I understand they have. So I think we're on the right track with this in terms, and you're right about follow-up. There's nothing better than the follow-up to make sure that things are being looked into, okay? So on the education front, you know, our argument is let's educate, not indoctrinate, and we are following up on that, and hopefully we'll have some positive things to say about that in the near future. So what else is on your mind, Jim?
Well, I think that it's important that conservatives, constitutionalists, even populists organize well prior to the March regular session of the legislature.
Yes.
And I think it's important to have a coordinator, a leader, in each legislative district who can get information to their legislator, so it won't be somebody way over in a different district. That is not effective to have Dr. Lou or whomever contacting a representative who is not yours.
Yes.
Less so with you because you're fairly well known and have a large organization. But we've got to have an organized citizen activist movement. For instance, who is our leader in the district for Representative Chip Brown in Mobile? Who is our leader in the Marty Wilcox district? Who is our leader in all of the new Dr. Mark Shirey district? We need a conservative leader who can keep up with what's going on and have a good relationship with their own state representative or state senator, rather than have everybody calling legislators who aren't theirs, they can't vote for or against. And that needs to be done before March.
Well, I do think that you're absolutely right about that. In the case of Mobile, Kay Day is our coordinator for Common Sense Campaign in Mobile, and we have people in that chapter who can do that. But when you look at the broader view of the state, it becomes really difficult to find those kinds of people in those districts, and that's something that we're going to have to look carefully at and try to come up with a plan like that. And I mean, this is something that we've tried to do for a long time, but it has not worked itself out. I will say this, that these freedom groups have popped up throughout Alabama, and I think that we can plug into that and make things happen along those lines, okay? But I think from an organizational standpoint, you hit the nail on the head with that, Jim.
Well,
So we're running, getting close to 10 to 10:28. It's 10, and I need to have Stephanie come on at 10:35. So what else is on your mind in terms of issues that we need to be following?
Well, we're hearing now out of Montgomery that they are not coming with a new gambling proposal this year. Now, you never can tell when some legislators may have a different idea about it, but there was a strong push for gambling proposals this year, this past year, and they did not gain traction and did not pass. But the new Speaker of the House, Nathaniel Ledbetter, said last week that he did not expect a major gambling push in the 2023 sessions. So that just needs to be monitored to see what's going on there. Now, there is some worry that if COVID comes back or some variant of COVID comes back, that there could be another push for mandatory vaccines and masks. So we need to be prepared and ready for that, including trying again to push some legislation such as the SB 31 from last time that did not pass. Governor Ivey seems to have moved from a vaccine and mask supporter early to very much a questionable. She says there won't be any mandates, and I hope that she sticks by that.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that. What about election integrity? What's your sense of where we are with that and what we need to be looking for?
We have not seen many reported cases of election problems in the state of Alabama. Now, I hear all kinds of reports and rumors, oh, there were problems in Madison County, there were problems in Jefferson County and elsewhere, but somebody needs to document those and get them together and report them to the Attorney General or to the incoming Secretary of State. But it looks like Alabama has been able to avoid the level of election problems that they've had in Arizona and Nevada and other states, thank goodness. But
yeah,
there are still people that wonder if we're just not finding out about the election problem. So it's something that it needs a lot of investigative work and research, and then what to do about it, then come up with a proposal. But right now, it appears that Alabama has a better election system than many of these other states.
Well, when you look at what happened in Maricopa County, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's and you see, it's my feeling here is that that's deliberate. Those people knew exactly what the problems were beforehand. They had the same problems in 2020. They spent 2 years fighting over whether or not to do an audit. I mean, so they were just in self-protection mode, and they just blew it again. But I do think that, you know, you've made this point, too, in our discussion, that incoming Secretary of State Wes Allen has already said that he is going to get rid of ERIC, which is a national database that supposedly allows the states to cross-reference all these people so that someone can't vote in New York and vote in Alabama when they're snowbirding down here or something like that.
Well, that's correct. And the incoming Secretary of State, who will go in January 16th, has notified ERIC that he intends to pull out the state of Alabama shortly after he goes in January. And if that's done, then that would may cease to be an issue. That would be a done deal. I would be highly surprised if he changes his mind. He has announced he's doing that.
Right. Well, Jim, we're just about out of time here, so just as a final thought, what are your final thoughts in terms of what we need to be, you know, kind of pulling together on?
There used to be a political system in Louisiana, where they needed some corrupt control, that there would be a shadow government. The citizen groups such as Common Sense or the Eagle Forum and all the others, in every district, there would be the state representative, and then there'd be the people's representative, who kind of kept an eye on the state representative. In every Senate district, you'd have your elected senator, and you'd have your citizen person going to the meetings, keeping up with what's going on, and keeping the two-way communications going. Can you imagine if we had, on 105 House members, if we had 105 citizen taxpayer activists to keep up with what their own representatives doing? That's doable. Maybe you wouldn't get 100% the first year, but we could get a number of them. And so I'm going to be pushing. The Founding Fathers said something like this. They would have town hall meetings and draw up what they call instructions to their representatives. Well, what a novel idea, the people writing instructions to their elected representatives.
Well, I think that you've just, again, hit the nail on the head with that. And I think that, you know, you've given us some ideas that we have to go forward with, and we will do that. In fact, our Alabama Conservative Coalition is meeting on Saturday, the 21st of January, and I would hope that you would be able to come up there and participate with us with some of these ideas. And I mean, we don't have to wait until the 21st to get some of this rolling, which we will. But Jim, I really want to thank you for coming on, and you know, best to you and your lovely wife. And I'll be getting in touch with Jackie to talk about some education issues here forthcoming. Okay, so take care.
Hey, good morning, Dr. Lou. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, glad to have you as always. Just to, by way of introduction, Stephanie is a the co-director of Health Freedom Alabama. She's been instrumental in doing so many good things for Alabamians in terms of defending their rights, particularly against forced vaccinations and masks. And as you just heard a minute ago with Jim Ziegler, evidently Governor Ivey has become less enamored of both of those things. And I think that Stephanie has, you know, some points that she wants to raise with everyone, so that going forward, we want to be able to make sure that our health freedom is really protected by the law, and not being, you know, driven into the dirt by special interests who don't want any part of the health freedom that we have a right to. So, Stephanie, thank you for coming on. As I said, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving. And now it's time to get back to work, I guess, huh?
That's right. There are no shortage of battles, for sure. And now that we've all had time with our family, it's time to kind of pop our heads up and look to the horizon and the next session and what's going to be happening there. And I absolutely adore Mr. Ziegler. He's been a friend of Health Freedom Alabama and a supporter of ours, just like Common Sense has. So it's always good to hear from Mr. Ziegler.
Yeah, I agree. He has been a gem for us, and you know, we call him the state agitator, but he agitates the establishment, and by God, we have got to have people like that and like you and your organization doing what you've done. So I mean, you mentioned that we've got, you know, the session coming up, so what is on your agenda? Let's talk about some of those issues. Okay.
Well, Health Freedom Alabama is going to keep pushing forward with the Alabama Health Freedom Act, and that is our model legislation that stops discrimination based upon your vaccination status. It's a really common sense approach to dealing with these mandates that are still happening in the private sector in Alabama. And Governor Ivey may have flip-flopped on that, because I think she finally read the temperature of her constituents going forward. You know, she forgot that she is now Republican and had to eject her Democrat roots when dealing with such an issue that we've had over the last couple of years. But, you know, Health Freedom Alabama maintains that your basic fundamental rights and liberties should at least begin at the threshold of your skin. And where there is risk, there must always be choice. So we will be absolutely moving forward again this session with the Alabama Health Freedom Act and holding those legislators accountable for not passing meaningful legislation last year that protected Alabama citizens from vaccine mandates.
Right. Now, is that HB 31? That's what that was called last year?
Last year, the bill number was HB 31. The name of the bill is the Alabama Health Freedom Act, and of course, it'll have a different bill number this year moving forward.
Yeah, I think we're most familiar with HB 31. So as soon as that bill gets a new number, we need to be able to put that out there so people understand it's the same bill, just with a different number. You know?
Absolutely. You know, actually, if you Google HB 31, there was so much momentum for that bill that if you put in HB 31 in Google, our bill in Alabama pops up, which is huge considering all of the HB 31s in every other state in our entire nation. This one was the most talked about, the most Googled, the most looked up in all of Google land.
Well, that's really interesting, but it goes to what I said in the introduction, that health freedom has become one of the most important groups in the state doing the hard work to protect health freedom. And I mean, I can't say enough good things about that, Stephanie. I know it's not you alone. I know it's Kristen Fondren, who is your co-director. But you all have worked magic, and it's wonderful to see. And the fact that you were able to get 400 people to walk around the state house, you know, on May or June?
Oh, that was last year. It was October of 2021.
Okay. Well, there it is. So, those sorts of things don't just happen, you know, they're planned, they're executed, and your execution was just absolutely extraordinary. So, we can't say enough good things about what you all do. So, if HB 31, you know, is going to come back with a different number, what else are you looking at for this coming session?
Well, thank you, Dr. Liu, for those accolades. We have amazing members that have joined with us, and we have some, you know, people who, you know, all of our members, we try to make it very easy for them to engage in the political process.
Right.
We give them calls to action that take them less than 30 seconds to complete but have huge impacts and send shockwaves across the legislative body so that they can have their voices heard. Last year, we generated nearly 500,000 emails just through our system in support of HB 31. And, you know, mask mandates is something else we're going to be focusing on this next session. We have got to fight against these woke school boards and protect our children.
Yeah.
We need legislation that's going to protect our children from such atrocities like mask mandates in the future. We need this set up in the legislature so that this will never happen again and parents never lose their right to say what goes over their child's face or what medical procedure they want their child to participate in. It really comes down to the core of freedom and liberty and parents' rights.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mention that because, as I recall, it was around late August last year when we were trying to get Baldwin County to rescind their mask mandates. So why don't you just give everyone a quick rendition of what happened there? Because it's an interesting approach to getting political change work, but the impact I thought was extraordinarily wonderful given the short time frame that you had to put together a political campaign against the mask down here.
Well, that wasn't just Health Freedom Alabama. That was Common Sense with you and several other really great citizen activists in the area who saw the same thing we saw, that, you know, our parents' rights were being taken away by our school board. And so with the help of those citizen activists, we were able to organize an airplane to fly over some really key football games in Baldwin County to spread the message that, hey, the school board needs to get those masks off those kids. We ran those for 2 weeks, and then the mask mandates for those kids, the message was received by that school board, and they lifted them pretty quickly. So that, I guess, model of pressuring our school board has actually trickled across the state in other forms and avenues, and there are several groups across the state who have taken hold and held their local school boards accountable, and there's been some disruptions in the school board elections because people are rising up and seeing what these school boards have done to their children, have done to their families, and they are unhappy, and I'm excited to see those ripples of freedom spread across our state.
Well, I'll take my hat off to you for what you all did in terms of getting those messages out and getting the airplanes. And yes, common sense was involved with it, but it was your idea and you all did it. The other part of the equation on this was that, you know, you all put together a team that went before one of the board meetings. We asked for a special board meeting and we got it. And the documentation that was brought out there clearly indicated that masking has no effect on preventing COVID, number one, and number two, that these children are the least likely to get COVID anyway. So when you looked at places like Sweden and other examples and the studies that were there, it was clear there's that no masking did not create lots of problems for Swedish children. And so I think that, to be honest with you, I think that we need to readdress this issue with the school board, because you're already seeing, you know, well, whether it's flu, whether it's, I think, RFD, whatever, that's a respiratory disease for kids, and COVID, these kinds of fear-mongering, you know, approaches are still out there. And I think that in the absence of a law, which is not going to come about until sometime when during the session, that we better do as much sort of like what we did the last time and have some people start going to these school board meetings and let them know that, you know, we're looking at the law, but we want you to do the right thing now. I mean, what's your sense of that?
You know, they got away with it then, and they will get away with it again in the future if we don't stop them with legislation to protect our children.
Yeah. Well, I mean, clearly legislation.
Thankfully, last session, Representative Chip Brown sponsored a bill to make that a parent's decision when it came to masking. So we're hopeful he'll be looking at that again and moving forward with that in the next session.
Okay. Well, once again, I do think that, you know, Jim Ziegler made the point as following up on what we're doing. And I think that the follow-up is clear and that you're on track to get the follow-up that you need in the law, and I think that can't come fast enough. So we'll certainly be watching and supporting you as best we can. So Stephanie, what else do you have in mind in terms of your legislative agenda?
Well, we really need to be looking at what the medical age of majority is in Alabama. Back in the 70s, the Democrats said that any child who is the age of 14 and older can make all of their medical decisions for themselves. Now, the legal age of majority in Alabama is 19, but we have this carve-out that says at the age of 14, children can go and make their own decisions medically, which is just absolutely abhorrent. I mean, we would not expect any middle schooler to be able to walk into a doctor's office and know their family history and know what is best for themselves and the medical treatments that they need. So we really need the legislature to look at this and raise the age of medical majority to at least the age of 18 or upon completion of a GED or a high school diploma. It's our contention that if you have graduated from high school, you have the skills and knowledge that you need to be able to move on in life, and that also includes your medical issues as well. But your parents should have a hand in that decision-making through that time while you were a child.
Well, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. And the interesting thing, though, is that you have this intersection here with this whole gender transition question that's under the, you know, under legal scrutiny right now, because I think Eagle Forum helped pass that gender bill, which really restricted providing any kind of medical hormones or any kind of operations towards gender transition until a certain age and with parent consent. And actually, it does prevent parents from doing this on their own, too, because some of these parents have sort of bored into all of this. So, I mean, you know, your bill here, I think, just buttresses the fact that, you know, we need to be able to make sure that children are not doing bad things to themselves. And while the VCAP bill certainly moves in the right direction, I would argue that this probably puts a bigger umbrella out there to prevent these kinds of things. Is that your sense of this?
Well, it does. I think the VCAT bill covers, if I'm not mistaken, up to the age of 18. But if you think about all of the medical procedures that are possible out there that a 14-year-old can either go to their school nurse and request or go to a clinic or a doctor by themselves and request, some doctors, once your child hits the age of 14, won't even allow an adult in the room with that 14-year-old.
Yeah.
And that's just a problem. You know, parents have the final say-so, or should have the final say-so, over their child's medical records or medical procedures or anything that is done to their children.
Well, you know that we'll certainly be behind you with that, and I know that you have a couple of other things that you want to do, and we still have a little bit of time. So why don't you, you know, let us know what else is on the agenda?
Well, we really have to look at how the state health officer is chosen in Alabama. That was a big problem over the past couple of years, and how he's chosen. There really needs to be some sincere effort at reorganizing that situation. As it stands right now, the state health officer is chosen by the Medical Association of Alabama, which is a private board. He's not, he doesn't have to answer to the governor or anybody else. So it's a problem, and we certainly have to look at that. And there's going to be, I think, a lot of heads that need to come together to reorganize that entire structure.
Well,
I think our basic freedoms and liberties to an unelected bureaucrat
exactly.
who's appointed by a private board.
Exactly. And I think a couple of years ago, at the height of the pandemic, there were a couple of bills along those lines. One to kind of restrict the governor's ability to impose the kind of lockdowns that we saw, as well as restricting the public health officer from, you know, just willy-nilly saying, well, it's time for a lockdown. And I think that this whole question of how the public health officer is selected, at this point, there's very little accountability to the public. And I think the argument has to be that the governor appoints and the Senate approves. And if that process is there, then it seems like we do have a system where there's much more accountability and transparency than what we have right now. Is that basically what you're arguing?
Right. There's got to be some accountability with the legislators there. We can't just have this an appointed position strictly by the governor, because if we end up with a governor that New York's got one day, God forbid, down the road, you know, they're going to have some health czar in charge of us again. So this really needs to be something that's confirmed by our legislators in some form or fashion.
Yeah, well, I guess the question now is, you have someone like Chip Brown who's going to lead the Health Freedom Act. Are you thinking, and you don't have to give out any names or anything, but do you have some people who are working with you and who have a draft of a legislation that can be used, you know, by the time the session's ready to go?
We are planning and preparing for next session and in conversations and discussions with lots of people about that. And when we get to the point where we can announce that legislation, we'll certainly let you be one of the first to know, Dr. Lee.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate that. All right. So in our closing minutes here, what are your final thoughts that you want to leave with our folks that are listening?
Well, I would love for your listeners, we have a special treat for them today, if they will go to healthfreedomalabama.com and register there for free as a member. There's a little text box right there when they hit submit. If they put in Dr. Lou, we are going to enroll them in a raffle for a free T-shirt. And we may be giving several of those away. So we'd love for your listeners to join up with Health Freedom Alabama. And what we do is we just make it super easy for you to engage in the legislative process, to hold legislators accountable for their bad votes on health freedom. We will send emails out during the session and various times throughout the year, and we mostly connect, though, by text message, which has been an excellent tool for our organization to connect with our members to, I guess, pick up that stick and whack it for freedom and liberty right when it needs to be thwacked.
Yeah, pick up the stick and beat them over the head with it, huh? I got it. Oh, Stephanie.
They have to learn to listen to their constituents. And yes. Their only way they're going to learn to listen to their constituents is by their constituents contacting them over and over again and holding them accountable.
Amen. Listen, Stephanie, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it. And we'll be in touch soon and follow up on some of your ideas and do what we can do from Common Sense Campaign to help you along, okay?
Thank you, Dr. Lou, for having me. You have a great day.
You too. Take care, dear. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, I mean, you know, folks, Stephanie and the Health Freedom Organization is just another example of what can be done if we're willing to take the time to make things happen. And I think that, you know, without this kind of citizen support, it becomes questionable whether anything would ever be done to fix some of the problems that are there. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I ended up having to fill in for Cody Phillips, who is the president of the Common Sense Campaign, over this past Thanksgiving, when I sent the Thanksgiving message out. And one of the things I said was that, you know, when you look at how Americans have always responded to issues and problems, you know, it's not in our DNA to just go belly up. That's really what it boils down to. And although that we have had to deal with, you know, Obama and all the problems associated with Obama and the disheartening reality that he got reelected, you know, in 2012, it took people a while to get back on their feet and become engaged because everyone was just shocked that something like that could happen. Certainly, Trump's election in 2016 injected everyone in the grassroots movement with a new sense of purpose and a degree of willingness to do what's necessary to further the MAGA movement. So I think that, you know, 2020 just kind of curtailed a lot of that, obviously. And then with the last year and a half under Biden, all we've seen is, you know, the usual things that I've talked to you all about. And I'm not going to repeat all of that, but it's been a disaster from foreign policy to domestic policy, okay? So the question now for us is, and you listen to Stephanie, and listen to how she's been able to get people engaged. And that's what we really need to be able to do, is to find those people who are not happy with what's going on and use the political process to our advantage to advance our agenda. The MAGA agenda is the only thing that's really going to save this country, I would argue. So it's going to be up to us on the national level as well as the state and local level to move forward with all this. And I would suggest to you that, you know, when it comes to the national issues, it's extremely difficult to have an impact on what's going on in Congress, okay? Now, we have our own, you know, congressman here, Jerry Carl, and he is going to be at the next think tank meeting on Saturday, the 3rd of December, at 8 o'clock at Mama Lou's restaurant in Robertsdale. And I would urge everyone who has an interest in what's going on the national level to go there and let Jerry Carl know your feelings about some of these issues. We're expecting that the Republicans, as Jim Ziegler said, is going that they will challenge, you know, our good buddy Biden. Well, we wanted them to challenge Obama in 2010 when we gave the Tea Party gave the Republicans back the House. And then in 2014, we gave them back the Senate. And what did they do with it? They squandered it, okay? They squandered it. And we can go back and you know, bemoan all of that. But the fact of the matter is, they can't squander it this time. And Jerry Carl is the point of the spear for Baldwin and Mobile counties where we are. He also represents other counties. I got that. But we need to press Jerry Carl to make sure that he is the tip of the spear.